Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important is creativity? While it doesn't often rank on lists of educational priorities, some experts consider creativity a critical ability, one that not only allows for self-expression and communication, but also paves the way for the kind of innovation that will help us succeed in an ever more challenging future. My guests today believe passionately in the power of creativity and in the idea that its exercise should not be considered a luxury, but a life skill. Robin Flatt is director of the Baker Idea Institute and executive artistic director for the Dallas Children's Theater. Susan Marcus is co-author of New World Kids, The Parent's Guide to Creative Thinking, and co-founder of the Learning About Learning Education Foundation. Both of them took part in last weekend's winter symposium of the Baker Idea Institute, where the topic was Creativity, the Next Literacy. Susan, Robin, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Hello.
Susan, we'll start with you since you are on the phone. How is creativity like literacy?
Well, it's a skill that can be nurtured in all children, and we believe that it's just as important and just as basic at this time in the world as our regular literacies of numeracy and literacy related to words and related to words.
And does it develop naturally in kids? A lot of people, I would think, Robin, say, well, my kids are already creative, so I'll just sort of let that go.
Well, of course, I think everyone is basically creative and has access to the sensory data. I mean, we're all absorbing sensory data constantly from the moment we're born, probably even before. But, you know, if someone doesn't tell you that that's important, you tend to ignore it. You tend to say, oh, well, okay, I have a great sense for rhythm, for instance, but that's not important. I really need to memorize this list of nouns, or I need to do X, Y, or Z.
Susan, how does standard education play into the process of creative development? My understanding in having read your book is that essentially by the time kids are in fourth grade, this is really not something that is valued anymore in the classroom.
Well, we're constantly thinking about higher-order thinking skills in regular education today, not in all cases. In this kind of thinking, which we feel like is absolutely teachable, is part of what you would call higher-order thinking skills. And those are not sought out early on often. That's one of the reasons we wrote our book for parents, so they can get a handle on this and begin to get an early start with their kids and know what to do and value it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say it's absolutely teachable. I wonder if it's measurable by the way that we have decided we really love to measure things in schools today.
Well, I don't think it is. And I think that's one of the things that we need to get over, actually. Little creativity still carries around a lot of old mythology. I think that it's something that's fluffy and not really important. But now when innovation is so important, creativity and creative thinking is the child's counterpart to innovation that we really need, and we believe that it's really basic.
Typically, Robin, there's one class in sort of most people's history of school that uses the word creative, and that's creative writing. Where did this idea arise that creativity was something separate and apart from every other subject? Why is it not part of our approach to science and history and mathematics?
Well, I think you touched on it a minute ago when you said, is this, you know, can we test this? Because is it measurable? You know, it's so much easier to test, this body of data. Can you, you know, how many thises are there? How many thats? That's much easier to test because then you can say, okay, yes, you have an answer that's right or no. When it comes to a process, you know, this doesn't have the same quantitative kind of measurement. I think it starts right at the very beginning of how we perceive information, how we process information. It's at the heart of who we are and how we function. But you know, so far we haven't figured out a way to measure it with precision, which is what, of course, the people who want to say, are we succeeding or failing with education, they feel like they need that data. So it gets marginalized. I think another thing that happens is it's something that's so universally available to us. When I say to you, you know, it really matters that you can have an idea about colors and textures, about sounds, about silence. Those things are very important. But, you know, it's accessible to everybody. So I think, oh, well, that doesn't matter. I can do that. Well, but we need to invest in each child, in each one of us, to allow time to explore those things so that you have a larger vocabulary for how to talk about it, how to think about it, and how to use it and how to integrate it into everything you do.
Let's talk about this concept, Susan, of the creative, or rather the sensory alphabet. Can you tell us what that is exactly?
Well, yes, it's a particular way of looking at the world, actually, that's related to the senses. I'll name off this vocabulary very quickly so that people can get an idea of specifically what we're talking about. So here we go. Line, color, texture, movement, sound, rhythm, space, light, and shape. And we often think of this vocabulary as something that we know already, or an arts vocabulary. But if you think about it a little more, it's just as important to physics or basketball or architecture or any other field.
So how do we go about introducing that alphabet?
Well, we teach children just like we teach them the ABCs, and it is a symbol system just like the alphabet, and it's the building blocks for creativity and creative thinking in many, many fields. I find that it tracks right along our reading literacy. So if you think of learning your alphabet as the first step to becoming literate, so then we learn language on top of that, and we learn words, and we learn how to write, and we learn that our eyes have to go from left to right in here in our culture to read. The same is true for this vocabulary, but what we're learning is a more elemental pattern language of the way to look at the world.
It strikes me, Robin, that we've gotten very good at identifying children who have trouble with the elements of literacy when we're actually talking about letters and words. But there isn't really anything out there to screen kids who might be having a hard time with something like the sensory alphabet.
Well, I think everyone has certain strengths with the sensory alphabet. I personally am more kinetic. I love movement. I love light. So I would start with movement. For instance, if I'm directing a play, I need to get things up on their feet and moving around in order to access some of the other elements I think that's very important to recognize that all children don't have the same strengths. And if we can identify what their strengths are, then that gives them the starting point for how they're probably going to approach everything in their life. And where we've been, whether it's a younger child or whether it's an adult or even a mature person, if we can help them find what's your starting point in life, what's your starting point with the senses, with this vocabulary, then opens all kinds of doors for them. And we see this over and over when we are able to work with young people, whether it's in a classroom setting or working with children in our own home or whatever. It's so basic and so accessible, and yet we kind of ignore it.
So what's the best way to figure out what a particular child's strengths are?
Well, I think what we were doing this weekend with the symposium was really a fabulous example of that Susan and Susie McAtee Mundy and Dr. Cindy Hebert set up round robin sessions. And so we, you know, we were, of course, adults and teachers and business people and social workers, a variety of kinds of people. They didn't care what background we came from. He says, okay, here is a wonderful group of textures. Now you go and create some texture tiles, and then we'll take a look at those and see what kind of textures you like. Susan, you why don't you pick up, because you helped set up a wonderful one. I particularly loved on light. Of course, me being a light person, I would love that anyway.
Well, what we developed at our lab school, let me get started. Step back a few years with our lab school at Learning About Learning in San Antonio was to develop a pedagogy around this way of looking and starting with the child, each individual child or individual period, and found ways of looking at their strengths as we found it as visual information in their creative work. So when we design programs, it's often we call it with open-ended activities that are creative activities that produce through the person's choice of media and their particular style comes out naturally. And so you just look at it and read it, but it is visual information. It's not in words or it's not in numbers. And mirroring that back to children who, of course, can't see it for themselves early on, and valuing it and showing them how to use it is extremely important.
So, go ahead.
I mean, for instance, I have two grandchildren. I have four grandchildren, actually, but two I'm thinking about at the moment. One is very very visual. I mean, he loves to sit down and draw things. We'll just draw page after page after page. His little sister is totally kinetic. I mean, she never stops running. I mean, it's moving up and down and around and tumbling and so forth. So, I mean, obviously, I can look at those two children and say, okay, this one's kinetic. We're going to have to start with a movement something with this child, whereas the other one, if we start with some visual things, some drawings, some putting pieces together, this guy may be an architect or, you know, I have no idea which way he'll go, but one could easily become a dancer or somebody in very physical kind of activities, and the other one may be much more cerebral.
So the idea, I guess, is to start with a strength as opposed to trying to shore up what is not so strong. Maybe that comes later?
Yeah, don't we get to, I mean, I know so many people who, for instance, said, I could not have passed biology if they hadn't let me draw things because I could, because I'm visual, I'm artistic, I can put things down, you know, in shape and line on the page. And by using that talent and that skill, that strength, I was able, no, this is not me, but I was able to learn the all of the, you know, memorize all the data that had to be memorized to pass biology. So, I mean, these are fabulous tools for helping any of us. I mean, whatever age we are, you know.
Yeah, Susan, I have to imagine that occasionally when you do apply this to adults, they're more surprised than the children are to figure things out.
Well, it's like looking through a new pair of glasses at how everything falls out. You're just it is surprising, and it's surprising for people to see the very clear patterns in their work when they pay attention and look at it through this lens.
We are talking to Susan Marcus, who is the co-founder of the Learning About Learning Education Foundation, and Robin Flatt, who is director of the Baker Idea Institute and executive artistic director of the Dallas Children's Theater. Both were participants in the winter symposium of the Baker Idea Institute this past weekend. The topic was Creativity, the Next Literacy. We would love for you to join our conversation. Get on the line now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Robin Flett, who is director of the Baker Idea Institute and executive artistic director of Dallas Children's Theater, and Susan Marcus, who is a co-author of New World Kids, The Parent's Guide to Creative Thinking, and a co-founder of the Learning About Learning Education Foundation. Both participated in the Winter Symposium of the Baker Idea Institute this past weekend. The topic was Creativity, the Next Literacy. If you want to join us, send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Robin, what happens when you walk into a classroom for the first time and you don't know what the background is of the students that you'll be assessing and working with, and you don't really know what their potential is?
Well, we've come up with, I think, a wonderful system of working in the schools where we start, when we have a unit of work we're going to do, we start with asking them a particular question. Perhaps it's about sounds. And we say, okay, what sounds do you hear around you? And then they'll tell you. And we'll talk to them about what sounds they might hear first thing in the morning or what sounds they might hear at home in the evening. And so we kind of make a collage of sound, you know, just written words about all these sounds that they hear. And then as we have explored that, and you'd be, it's just really amazing because children who are very shy, feel very uncertain, they're not very successful in school, all of a sudden have answers. I mean, they become the expert.
Yeah, it's not a question they can get wrong.
They cannot get the question wrong. And, you know, they know because that's been their experience. So they'll want to tell you. So you've got all these hands going up and these kids just really just jumping all over themselves to participate. And then you say, okay, now we've gotten this far. Now, what do you think if we were going to study the, say, the Underground Railroad? Now, you've got plane noises, you've got trucks backfiring, you know, in your list of sounds. Do you think we'd have heard those? And so they have to then think about what kinds of sounds might they have heard if they were in a different era. So then we create a collage of sounds from that era and move them then into the curriculum for that era. But they enter it as authorities because they have already participated. They have already brought from their own background things that they know and that they're authorities on, that's part of their sensory database. And that's, I think, the crux of what we're not doing in the schools, is we're not tapping in to the students' sensory database on a regular basis. And when we can find the way to link that database to core curriculum of whatever it is, whether it's math or science or history or social studies, then those students wake up. They come alive, and we've documented this. Now we work in anywhere from 20 to 30 schools a year in Dallas. We in the classroom during language arts time, during learning time, and we just see an enormous change in these children. They come in so shy they can barely speak, and then they end up feeling very confident and able to take charge of their learning process.
Well, it certainly sounds like they're suddenly immersed in what it is they're trying to learn. You know, it surrounds them 360 degrees as opposed to staring at them from across the page.
Well, you know, I mean, so often these kids come in and they don't know all these answers. They're struggling with the language. They've got to deal with all this memorization and so forth. And we're trying to teach them all these tools rather than connecting with that individual, what that child's strength is, which, of course, takes a little bit more time, which is a problem. But connecting with their strength and showing them that they have something to bring. They have a gift to bring to us in the classroom. So if we can honor that, then they're ready. You know, they'll be much more ready to learn.
Susan, what is the role of play in the development of creative skills?
Oh, play is pretty much the heart of creativity. It's a place for children to be involved with ideas in the first place, and it's the beginning of what we call metacognition. It's their chance to they rehearse, they imitate, they invent, they fantasize, they get to try on, try out, experiment, rearrange, start over again. They express themselves, and mostly it all has to do without having any consequences, so that they are really, really immersed in many goals, many processes, many ideas. And we find, and I think as Piaget said, to learn is to invent in the first place. So we need to give children time for that. It's really important.
Yeah, and curiosity is such an important
exactly.
part of that. I mean, that if we can tap into that child's curiosity, then that child becomes a learner. But we're so worried about, are we going to get the right answer, that, you know, it pulls them away from the learning process rather than thrusting them into it. And so I just hope as we go forward here, we'll find ways to energize these children and let them know it's okay to fail, that that's part of learning. It's, you don't have to always get the right answer. You know, you can try something and decide you don't like it. You can then reevaluate it and go back and reframe it, you know, or look at it from another point of view. That's so very important in the learning process. And that doesn't, of course, fit into any test. So therefore, right now, it's very hard in the classroom for those teachers to give much opportunity for children to explore.
So I know a lot of parents sort of take this on for themselves and for their children. I wonder if both of you can comment on the importance of not making everything perfect. So if your kids are playing that they own a restaurant, maybe you don't want to run out and buy absolutely perfect replicas of what a chef might have. You might let them use a cardboard box for the stove, and you might let them use a stick for a spoon and also for a knife. Can we overdo it in trying to give them everything that they need to be creative?
Exactly. We call those scratch materials, and the more the child needs to step into the breach, the more and bring their imaginations to bear, the more exercises they have for their imagination.
It is vitally important that, you know, and I think it's very important too for the parent to realize that it's important for them to stay out of the way.
I know, as opposed to directing every little thing.
Yeah, and like for instance, my mother's she's wonderful with clay and a sculptor and so forth, and she and my sister, my youngest sister, were taking class together, and they were both making masks, and my mother's mask turned out quite well, and my sister judged that hers was not very good, so she took her clay and wadded it up and threw it away. And my mother said after that she realized she should never be creating something right next to her, you know, my sister, because that she didn't want that sense of comparison. There was one thing to be inspiring the children, but it's another thing to be, you know, drawing it for them or correcting it, and then they feel like, well, I can never do this as well, so why should I try?
Right.
And I guess there's also the issue of, you know, there, schools that are lucky enough to have visual arts programs, very often there's
some fabulous ones.
There's one model for doing things right. And there's,
yes.
you know, two or three kids that really hit it, and then a few kids who just don't get it at all, mm-hmm. or choose mm-hmm. not to do it that way. Is there a way to help them navigate an art class that might not be as open-ended as you might hope?
It's important for children to help children understand that they have strengths in some area or another. It may not be in, you know, like drawing. You may not be a linear mind. You may be a 3D mind, somebody who naturally and intuitively sees space in three dimensions. You'll have a different set of strengths. And we find that using this this vocabulary as a lens, looking into other fields of study, it helps them to be able to be predictive of what will be easy for them. What will be if they're maybe they'll be terrific at solid geometry and not so good at algebra, because they have very, very different qualities. One being very 3D and one being very linear.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Scott in Denton. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a bilingual teacher here in Denton, teaching elementary school, first grade. I think it's very important to have the creative process for the kids to be able to understand the curriculum, and I wanted to applaud the efforts of Robin Platt. And actually, I grew up in the Dallas Theater Center.
Oh, my goodness.
Great.
Well, me too.
Thanks so much for your call, Scott, and it's good to know you're doing good work out in the community. Are teachers empowered these days to in most public schools to allow creativity to be a big part of what they do?
Well, I think they have a tough time with it. And I think there's so many demands on their time and their efforts, and there's so much pressure for a large percentage of the class to be able to pass the tests and things. I think it is really cut severely into that think time, that creative time, that explore time. And I think it's a huge concern. And, of course, this is part of why we developed Dallas Children's Theater, so that there's time outside of school so that kids can have an environment in which they can try things out. They don't have to be perfect. They can, you know, take an idea. They can turn it into words or to a character, et cetera. But we have to have these places for kids to do this. And I think Susan's book is so brilliant because it's encouraging parents to, you know, really, you can take a lead. There are all kinds of very simple things you can do with your child to make them more aware of the sensory world around them, because that's such a vital vocabulary which they have in their bodies if they just take time to listen to it, you know.
One of the things that's beginning to happen on the educational scene, of course, is this deliberation about 21st century literacies, and creative thinking is beginning to be on that agenda, which we're thrilled about. And we've also just gotten the teacher version out of our book called New World Kids at School. That's a teacher's guide for teachers that want to begin to get creativity in the classroom in a deep way, and it responds to what teachers call differentiated classroom, and also, of course, the individual differences in cognition, which are known mostly as the theories of multiple intelligences at this point.
Which is a challenge, I know, for teachers, because usually there's only one textbook, regardless of, you know, you might have, you know, 18 different minds that work in 18 different ways in a classroom, but there's one curriculum that's sort of designed to go in a certain way.
Yes, it's true. And, and that's one of the things that that's why there's a lot of concern about that, and we're beginning to think about how to think under that, how to think in a more elemental and way, because so many of these fields of study are changing as we speak. Probably the most constant thing that will characterize the environment that these children are growing up in is one of change. And we need to add this way of thinking and this literacy to help them cope with change. Our future is literally in their hands, and they need a lot of creativity to cope with what we're giving them.
Susan Marcus and Robin Flatt are my guests. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Robin, most parents are proud to talk about their kids' creative impulses and creative abilities, but you hear a lot of parents who will brag about their kids' creativity and then in the very next sentence say, I don't know where it comes from because I am not creative myself. And I'm wondering how much you find that kids tend to internalize what mom and dad say about themselves.
Oh, I think that's very, very obvious. But I think parents are underselling themselves. You know, I think my father is Paul Baker, and
So you had it in your family.
So my family, it was they saw to it, of course, that I had dance class, that I had music lessons, and of course I went to museum after museum and heard symphonies. I thought everybody got to do all that, you see. So it was a very, very rich sensory kind of childhood, which was really exciting. But my father really tried to teach everyone that, you know, you are creative. You have wonderful resources in you if you don't shut them off. And he developed an amazing class, kind of, we called it the philosophy class. I think it now is still continuing at like Booker T. Washington High School as one of their core classes that all the students, no matter which cluster they're going into, would still come in and take that entry class and study the elements. I think they call it the essential elements. And so they are getting a wonderful exposure to this this approach, the elements of form. And I think we do hear from many of their parents, well, I don't know how my kid, you know, how did they discover this? Where, how did they, I'm not creative. How can they be so creative? But I think the parents, it's in there. They just didn't allow themselves the opportunity, allow themselves to explore the arts. They felt like maybe intimidated. Well, maybe I'm not, well, like me, I can't draw a line and make it look very exciting. So, you know, if that were all, I would probably have withdrawn. But somebody told me, no, it's okay if you like movement, or it's okay if you like light, or if it's okay if there's other elements, you know. We don't all have to have the same strengths. So I think, you know, too many people try one shot at it in one element and write it off, you know. But I think many people do hope their children have some creative talents. And value those, you know. But of course, there's others that think, no, I just want my child to learn to load boxes on a truck. I don't want them to do around with this artsy stuff.
Well, so you can only load boxes extremes. For so long, I
exactly,
guess.
Exactly, yeah. But it's sometimes disheartening to those teachers that are trying to work with children to, you know, show them this wonderful potential out here that is open to them. And, you know, the parents are afraid. They want them, I'm using boxes as an example of, you know, they want them to have something that they're sure they can earn a very clear living with.
They could be trying corporate cases or anything else, right?
Well, as a culture, we've put so much emphasis on the three R's that we designed into public education to the neglect of most everything else. So when children grow up thinking they're not creative adults, it's often because it was just never valued as a child.
Susan Marcus and Robin Flatt are here. Both participated in the recent winter symposium of the Baker Idea Institute. The topic for that was Creativity, the Next Literacy. You can find information about upcoming Baker Institute events at bakeridea.org. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Robin Flatt, who is Executive Artistic Director of the Dallas Children's Theater and Director of the Baker Idea Institute, and Susan Marcus, a co-author of New World Kids, The Parent's Guide to Creative Thinking, and a co-founder of the Learning About Learning Education Foundation. You can learn more about the Baker Idea Institute, which just concluded its winter symposium, at bakeridea.org. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address think@kera.org. Justin in Dallas writes, is a traditional education still appropriate for a true career creative, or should apprenticeships be developed to grow these individuals? What do you think about that, Susan?
Well, I feel that, again, getting back to this elemental way of looking at the world lets you see across the boundaries of different disciplines, which actually is a not only as disciplines change all the time at this point in the world, it's also gives you more ideas yourself, and that fundamental pattern making ability that is what we call a hallmark of creative thinking and a creative mind.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Rebecca in Mansfield. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I'm a fourth grade bilingual teacher in the Mansfield area, and I wanted to comment and thank your guests for bringing up such an important topic in education right now. But one of the things that we talk about the amount of time that children need for creativity, but I was wondering if they could speak to the amount of time teachers need to incorporate creativity into the classroom. I know for me, when I want to do a creative lesson, I need to spend time becoming creative myself in order to tap in to my children's creativity in the classroom and allowing for those kind of opportunities. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, wow. I love that question. Well, I think, you know, I think so often teachers say to me, oh, you know, because I don't have 30 minutes to do this, I can't do anything. And, you know, I think there are lots of very simple things that I would suggest a teacher start out with. For instance, if you're about to read a story, have the kids stand up beside their desk and just take the position, take the physical position that one of the characters might have. You know, if it's a rabbit or if it's a very tall, skinny person or if it's a very old, slumped person or you know, whatever. But just, you know, just to try out the shape and the physicality of a character for a moment before you start reading the story. I mean, that already gives that child a whole nother way to relate. And, you know, you're reaching another learning surface, which is so important. I think I love it that you would say, you know, how do I have time to be more creative myself? Start with the things you're comfortable with. If it's me, I'm always going to start a class off with some movement because that's my thing. Susan is probably much more visual, so she's probably going to start something off in a more visual way with lines and shapes and colors, whereas I might do lines and shapes and colors with my body. So there are lots and lots of ways to do it, and just a little, you know, just a little bite will so inspire children, you know, and then you can learn to control it as you go along. You don't have to solve everything all at once. Just take some little pieces and say, well, here, let's talk about the sounds in this story or in this situation or the sounds of these words in this language, you know, and just focus on sounds and take another week and focus on colors and take another week and focus on shapes and silhouettes or, you know, our rhythms. I mean, just treat yourself to looking at your material through a different lens each week. And I'll tell you, as an artist who's done this all my life, I get so inspired and excited when I do that because I'm forcing myself to look at a situation a different way, from a different viewpoint. And if you look at several of these, you're going to hit upon the strengths of your students, not all of them with every one, but across the board, you will hit their strengths at one point or another.
Do you have anything to add to that, Susan?
I certainly agree. And all children have strengths in one area or another. And so, of course, that's your goal, is to get that sense of, I can do that, I can do that, you know, in every child in some way. And Cynthia Herbert, our colleague, has included approaches to reading with particularly how to design reading instructions here in our book. So that will help also. Very specific.
So most people who create things for a living have to go back and edit or polish the things that they've done. I'm curious about what you both think in terms of constructive guidance from adults. Is it okay to be honestly, if constructively critical of a child's work, or do we praise everything at first and sort of wait until they're a certain age before we say, well, you might want to go back and revisit that?
Oh, my goodness. You have to give some guidance. I mean, you know, if you have a group of kids we're putting on a play and they're speaking so softly you can't hear them, well, we have to work very hard on, no, you have to say these lines louder. If they're racing around and they're supposed to be playing a feeble character, well, we have to talk to them about the rhythm of that. But it doesn't, you know, but you find things to compliment and then to make suggestions. Well, why don't you look at, have you thought about, have you watched, have you observed how someone who is not feeling very well walks around? And so you use their powers of observation, and I love it when we can lead them to making their own observations and their own evaluations about, well, this might be better. This might communicate what I'm trying to say with more clarity.
Exactly. We found that children get into wanting to polish something, getting a presentation ready, as well as adults. And sometimes we want them to be have as many ideas as possible and get to a certain point in a little creation, and then it's okay. You don't need to go on to the presentation or the polishing stage. And it's something you can evaluate with your children often.
Let's go next to Grapevine and speak to Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I have a 2.5-year-old, and we're starting to think about preschool. And I've done a lot of reading on the Montessori method and also the Steiner or Waldorf method. And I just want to see what your guests thought about those two methods, because Montessori is focused on work and jobs and doing things a certain way. And Waldorf is more concerned with imaginary play and storytelling.
Well, I think, you know, of course, both have a lot of advocates, and a lot of children have done well with both. But I would always lean more toward the less rigid imaginative opportunities.
I think they would do a little bit different jobs. At Montessori, they're not focused on individual differences and creativity, particularly. They're letting children practice what will happen during the rest of their lives is one way, and it's a certain way of organizing your mind. I think that there's certainly room for both.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak to Griff. Hey, Griff.
Hi. I was just going to toss out a comment. I have a junior at a major university in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and she doesn't really need it, but she's taken art for years privately, and she's won a lot of awards here and there. And so I finally got her to take an art course, and the first piece she did, the professor walked up and said, "Well, that's dumb." So it doesn't end in the second grade or kindergarten. It follows you all the way up to college, and it doesn't matter whether it's free public education or you're paying $20,000 a semester. So just tossing that out.
Yes, very important comment. You know, this is why it's so important for us to have spaces which nurture places to nurture the creative process. We all need an environment in which we can feel safe, in which we can try out our ideas. We always have to remember that every idea is fragile. It's very timid. It's very shy. It's very afraid. And, you know, I mean, here I am. I've had these fabulously creative parents. My mother's a mathematician and an artist. I still, every time I come up with it, like when I came up with the idea to do the Baker Idea Institute, I went, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? Oh dear. You know, it's very natural to be very, very frightened by an idea, you know, because an idea can lead you into all kinds of things. And so, that was not a very, that teacher, you know, should be taken up, you know, to the top of a hill and, you know, and escorted out of the country. But, you know, we just have to overcome those and try to go back to, you know, saying, you know, keep on, if you like this idea, you keep on with it, because, you know, there's something you want to say in this idea. So as parents, as people around artists, you know, it's very important to be supportive, to, you know, make comments. Sometimes it's not the most brilliant idea in the world, but to find a way to never shut off that desire to have ideas and that desire to let something grow.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, we did a show about people's love of karaoke, of all things. And what came through with that was the idea that we have so professionalized music that we forget that whether we sound beautiful or not, everybody can sing.
Yes.
And it seems that we've done the same thing, Susan, also with art of all kind. If you can't really make a painting that somebody would buy, then people tell you you shouldn't pick up a paintbrush.
Yeah, absolutely. And how many adults have said that they have such a distinct memory of Miss Brown, their second grade teacher, who did not put their drawing on the wall with everybody else's, so they have never picked up a paintbrush since. But we have to remember that's going on with, you know, math and reading and everything else right now also. I mean, not just right now, certainly, but all along the way, because we've built a very competitive and linear way of looking at education right now.
We have so many events where I just always hate it that there's only one winner at the end, and of course everybody else are failures. You know, I think is so devastating for many, many of our people, you know. And we have to find ways to overcome that because our culture seems to be bent, hell-bent on doing this. But in the arts, you know, we do have a much better chance to be inclusive, to be supportive. And if we're consciously working at creating environments for growth, creating environments for discovery, curiosity, that's a job that we cannot let up on. All of us that see the importance of this have to continue to be warriors for the creative process, warriors for respecting that kind of work and for moving it to the middle, to the center where it needs to be.
Absolutely, and that innovation is something that is not only the arts, of course, but goes across the board. And we're trying to, Robin and I both are trying to be warriors and getting ways out there that you can see it and ways to do it.
You write in the book New World Kids, Susan, it is worth the time, the trouble, and the mess, which implies, of course, that we'll experience all of those things as we're helping our kids be creative. But I have to imagine that this is also kind of a relationship builder for parents and their children.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can. It's simpler to often to plant children in front of the television at the end of the day, or let them be completely absorbed in video games for 3 hours instead of asking them to please make place cards for the, you know, Thanksgiving dinner that we're about to have. So, and then providing the materials and the specificity and or whatever is age appropriate for that child. So it does take, absolutely, it takes focus and attention, and is extraordinarily rewarding. We've put in into the book lots and lots of over 200 activities for children and parents to do, and children and parents to do together, and also just built into it, everyday activities. There's a whole section called 10 Ways to Go to the Zoo, so that you go with a viewpoint and go with an idea of what you want to come back with.
Susan Marcus and Robin Flatt have been my guests. The next, very quickly, Baker Idea Institute is in March.
It's in March 6th and 7th. And we have some absolutely fabulous people coming. We're going to be looking at kinetic.
We can find those guys online at bakeridea.org. Thank you both so much. It's been wonderful to have you. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.